Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Melissa Liu representing the United States. The only issue in this appeal is whether or not Idaho robbery counts as a crime of violence under 4B1.2 of the 2015 sentencing guidelines. And it does under the enumerated offenses analysis, where courts apply Taylor and compare the crime of conviction to the generic definition of the enumerated offense to figure out whether there's a categorical match. In Becerra Lopez, this court did just that with California robbery, which is facially identical to Idaho robbery, and concluded that California robbery was a crime of violence under 2L1.2, which is an analogous guideline to 4B1.2 at issue in this case. Now, importantly, both guidelines enumerate robbery and extortion as crimes of violence. So if we look at the Idaho robbery statute, it's a match for the definition of generic robbery, except that it does criminalize conduct involving injury and threats to property. Now, similar to what the court did in Becerra, we can look at both robbery and extortion. And so that piece of Idaho robbery that's too broad for just generic robbery does fall within generic extortion.
So isn't that why we should be concerned about the change to the definition of extortion?
The change to the definition of extortion was promulgated in the 2016 guidelines, which are not at issue in this appeal.
Why are they not at issue?
Because the district court sentenced the defendant under the 2015 guidelines.
I struggled. I've looked at this. Among other things, the district court adopted the pre-sentencing report, which used the 2016 guidelines, and ordinarily you use the guidelines in effect at the time of sentencing unless there's an ex post facto effect. I understand there was a lot of discussion about the 2015 guidelines, and there are reasons why defendant might have encouraged that because it might have given a legal argument. But in the end, as I've gone through it, and as the district court really tried to struggle with this issue, I didn't come out at the end having a clear sense of which set of guidelines was actually applied. Can you point me to something that answers that question?
Yes. Well, I think the clearest indication that the district court applied 2015 and not 2016 is that the court did not consider that amended definition that was added in the 2016 guidelines.
Well, did anybody know
ask
about
him to?
It?
Did anybody ask him to?
No one asked him to. But,
right.
But I think that is the clearest indication, because if the court had actually applied 2016, it would have looked at that amended definition.
Well, if somebody had pointed it out, my sense was that nobody in the room was conscious of that particular change.
I can't speak for what the court
was.
You
were lucky enough not to be in the room.
We certainly missed it, and we acknowledge that. But I don't think
and it's a sticky area. We're not trying to throw stones. This was a very sticky area. And as you said, even Becerra Lopez, by relying on extortion, it's a little bit of a marine teaser. And I understand these statutes, of course, they're identical. They're verbatim.
Yes.
But the district court was concerned that maybe Idaho had interpreted it differently anyway, and I think you have a strong argument on that point.
Yes.
But there's still this concern about 2015 or 2016. I think the district court does pretty clearly adopt the amended PSR, and that relies on 2016, right?
Yes, but I do think the strongest indication that the court didn't actually apply 2016 is that the court did not consider that new extortion definition that only appears.
Well, if you weren't aware of it, why should we be so confident that the court was so aware of it? I mean, I'm willing to stipulate the judges know everything, but it was never mentioned.
It's pretty tough.
It's something that likely would have been brought up if people were conscious of it. So why does that really tell us that the judge was mindful when he decided, no, I'm going to disregard that and apply 2015?
Well, I think if you look at the fact that the court didn't consider that amended extortion definition, along with what the court said in the record, where it basically said, you know, yes, I do think there is an ex post facto problem, potentially. It bought into the defendant's argument that the 2015 guidelines should apply. I think those two things combined really indicate where the district court was thinking. And the district court was sentencing the defendant under the 2015 guidelines. In fact,
what if we can't tell? Or I guess more to the point, what if we disagree? What if we think it's more likely that he was sentencing pursuant to the 2016 guidelines? Then what would we need to do? Would we ask you to go back and brief this for him so that he can understand that there was, because it was not teed up to the district court, in fairness. And
yes,
we sure don't know everything, so I don't know. We would expect him to be clairvoyant and know that there had been this change, which is a very significant change, particularly given that it's verbatim going to match up with California, and that's going to affect an awful lot of cases.
It is. And yes, I think if this court were to disagree with our position, and indeed I think defendant's position is that he was sentenced under 2015 as well, if the court were to be unclear on that, the fact still remains that the district court did not consider this amended extortion definition under the 2016 guidelines. So I think in either instance, the appropriate course would be to reverse and remand for resentencing, in which case the district court would have the benefit of briefing and really have the opportunity to really look at this issue, which is an issue of first impression in the District of Idaho.
If we decide that it was a 2015 guideline that he was relying upon, then your argument is?
Then my argument is that the district court got it wrong, because Idaho robbery is categorically a crime of violence under the 2015 guidelines. And I think where the district court went wrong is when it agreed with the defendant that Idaho case law had interpreted Idaho robbery in a way that made it broader than California robbery and no longer a crime of violence.
Or I don't know how to pronounce it. Is it BB or?
I say BB, but BB.
It's that case. You think he just read that incorrectly?
I think so, yes, Your Honor, because BB explicitly says Idaho robbery requires intent to use force or fear to overcome the will of the victim. Now, Beeb did not dispense with that intent requirement. What the court did was it said there's sufficient evidence in the record to affirm the jury's finding that the defendant had the requisite intent in that case.
But counsel, how about the language in that case that said fear and the force of fear may be created not merely by threatening words or gestures, but also by threatening circumstances? Doesn't that go beyond what the California courts have interpreted under the robbery statute?
It does not, Your Honor.
Why not?
Because if we look at the generic definitions of robbery and extortion, which is the starting point for this analysis, generic robbery is defined as aggravated larceny containing at least the elements of misappropriation of property under circumstances involving immediate danger to the person. And generic extortion is obtaining something of value from another with his consent by the wrongful use of force, fear, and threats. So nothing in the language of those generic definitions places a limit on how the force or the fear can be created or what types of force or fear count. And I think tellingly, if we look at the Molinar case in which Judge Kristen was a panel member recently, the court noted that putting in fear can be achieved by words, acts, or circumstances. And so that language in Beeb does not actually make Idaho robbery broader than California robbery or broader than the generic definitions of the
offenses. So, counsel, the Knee case from Idaho?
Yes.
It found the elements of robbery were satisfied when the defendant wore a ski mask and kept his hand in his coat pocket. You think that's consistent with the threatening words or gestures language?
Yes, I think the Knee case is actually helpful to us, because what happened there was, again, they were reviewing a jury conviction, and they found that there was sufficient evidence in the record for the jury to find that the defendant had, in fact, used fear. So Knee also doesn't dispense with this requirement in Idaho robbery that the defendant needs to intend to use force or fear. Now, compare that with California.
But bodily injury, fear of violence, as opposed to fear of damage to reputation or fear of... Is that your argument?
No, I think both count, because we're looking at both generic
not
robbery
as applied
and
in
generic
that case.
Extortion.
The facts in that case, whether reviewing the jury verdict is quite specific to the evidence that the jury heard, right?
Right.
And it is, as Judge Bolton summarized.
Yes. Yes, that's correct. And compare that to California robbery, which pretty clearly doesn't require intent to use force or fear, as made clear in the Anderson case. I would submit that the district court simply got it backwards, and that Idaho robbery is actually narrower than California robbery and generic robbery and extortion because it does require that intent to use force or fear. Now, even assuming that the district court was right, and even assuming that Beeb somehow dispensed with that intent requirement, which I don't think it did because it says clearly in there that robbery requires intent to use force or fear, that would make Idaho robbery identical to California robbery, which also doesn't require intent to use force or fear, and it would still be a categorical crime of violence. So under either interpretation, the district court got it wrong.
California's statute was saved only because of the hybrid robbery extortion.
That's right. Correct.
And so do we have a similar situation in the Idaho statutes where you can use the extortion robbery hybrid?
Yes, we do. And this court has said, both in Becerril and in Velazquez-Bosque, that it is okay to combine two enumerated generic offenses when both robbery and extortion are enumerated as crimes of violence.
There's a split of authority under the new commentary definition of extortion, right? Courts have not agreed.
Courts have not agreed. And I think
our court hasn't weighed in.
Our court has not weighed in. I believe that issue is teed up in the Nichols case, which is currently pending. And I do think that would be dispositive potentially under the 2016 guidelines. But again, the issue that we have raised in this appeal is whether the district court got it right in the 2015 guidelines.
Does Nichols involve California statute?
It does, yes.
Thank you.
The current status of Nichols?
I'm not aware. I don't believe there's been a decision, and I admit I don't know if oral argument has been held or not.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Thad Blank from the Federal Defenders on behalf of Mr. Powell. Before I forget, Nichols, I believe, is scheduled for oral argument on the 18th, mid-month this month. But we didn't make this easy for the district court, but the district court ended up ruling that Mr. Powell did not have a conviction for a crime of violence on his record. The government, in this appeal, doesn't have an argument that the district court got that fundamental ruling wrong. And we agree with what the government said in an earlier appeal, that this court is reviewing the ruling, not the reasoning. It's not grading the district court's homework assignment. And so the government's claim that there's some sort of more exacting standard of review applied to this Amendment 798 argument is not correct. This court can affirm for any basis in the record. That's the difference between being the appellant and being lucky enough to be the appellee.
You're not used to being on that side of the room.
I'm sure
you like
not.
The view over there, don't you?
I'm enjoying it in this circumstance because I frequently am in the position where the government has the opportunity to refine or improve their arguments on appeal, and this court is allowed to consider that as long as that argument supports the ruling that the district court made below.
Is any part of your argument going to rely on the district court's invocation of the rule of lenity?
I don't think that this panel has to get there, no. I think the Amendment 798 argument is not, after the amendment, it's not close, and the court doesn't have to invoke the rule of lenity, although the Tenth Circuit case that we cited in our 28-J letter, that's how they view it as closer than I think it is.
But it would leave unresolved a question of whether there's a match or not. And that is typically an on-off switch. It's a black or white. There's a match or there's not a match, right?
It would be very peculiar for us to rely
on that rule here.
On the rule of lenity?
Mm-hmm.
Right, because it's a categorical approach. It's just a question of whether the conduct criminalized by the state of Idaho extends beyond.
Not relying on that here?
I didn't cite it in any of my briefs, so no, I don't think I'm relying on it. I don't think I need to rely on it for this court to get where it's going.
Which set of guidelines did the district court rely on, counsel?
I don't think that the district court specified because it wasn't material to the basis for its ruling. I think that the I have to say that the government's argument that we cabined our argument to the 2015 guidelines is incorrect. The second argument that we made, this threatening circumstances argument, we viewed it and stated explicitly that that didn't depend on which version of the guidelines that they accept. So I point the court to ER 112, which is the conclusion of our first response to the government's objection. And I'm quoting, Idaho robbery does not categorically qualify as a crime of violence. That is true under the 2016 guidelines because, and then I'm excerpting and then resuming quotation, this is even more true under the 2015 guidelines, dot, dot, dot. And so we were making two arguments. One was this convoluted argument that there was an ex post facto issue under the 2015 guidelines because robbery wasn't enumerated, it depended on the residual clause, Johnson had invalidated the residual clause. The district court rejected that argument. It said it was confident that Becerra Lopez applied, which if it made that statement, it meant that it was considering both robbery in the commentary note and extortion factually listed. So it didn't buy that argument. Instead, it bought our other argument, which here we said applied regardless of which version of the guidelines the court adopted.
And if we can't tell, excuse me for interrupting, counsel, but if we can't tell which version, given the number of cases like delete, to be affected and the fact that under the new guideline there's this new definition of extortion, how do we go forward? I mean, this wasn't even briefed to the district court.
Well, I think the district court correctly ruled and this court should affirm. And
He didn't have this argument. As far as we can tell, the district court didn't have this argument to consider about the new definition of extortion.
Well, it's a purely legal argument. We presented it on appeal as a reason to affirm, and here the government chose not to engage with it. And typically this court requires a party to specifically and distinctly make an argument in order to adopt it. And so the government wrote in their brief that there should be an opportunity for further factual development of the record, but this isn't a factual question.
I agree it's not a factual question, but it's a really important legal issue that would be precedential if we decide how this, and it would have been decided without the benefit of briefing.
Well, I disagree that it's decided without the benefit of briefing. We briefed it, the government chose not to engage, and I think that if this court rules on it, it should do so or would it be appropriate to do so in a way that's not precedential beyond this case. This is just a matter of which argument
the government... It doesn't work.
Well, the government doesn't.
It doesn't work for us to say this ruling is for this case only, because if we make a ruling as a matter of law, it's the law of the circuit.
Well, the ruling would be that the government did not choose to make the argument that under the 2016 guidelines, Idaho robbery remains a crime of violence.
I see what you're saying, and so we say under those particular circumstances, they
right.
lose because they didn't.
Does Nichols tee that argument up?
Nichols tees it up in the context of California. And I think that just highlights that the government made a choice here, that it didn't want to make the same argument. I mean, we cited it as a related case in our brief. Instead of making a similar argument, they just put in a footnote that they're not conceding the argument. But they also didn't make the argument, so why should they get credit for it?
That's how you think we could cabin this ruling, just that the government hasn't engaged.
The government hasn't
without
engaged.
Without creating precedent. Where the district court didn't have the benefit of the briefing.
It's not a rule. Yeah, it's not a ruling on the merits as litigated because it's not litigated. It's just a concession. And of course, this court could do an unpublished disposition as well, which doesn't have precedential effect. But the one other thing.
But just to be clear, your position is you're not sure which set of guidelines the district court relied on.
I don't think the district court specified, because I don't think it viewed it as material to its
ruling. I know the
ruling.
District court didn't specify counsel, but I'm just asking you, what is your position? I understand he didn't articulate it, but...
I guess my position is that it appeared that he was ruling under the 2016 guidelines, because he didn't view there being an ex post facto issue
uh-huh.
with respect to which version of the guidelines applied, so he applied the law, which is you use the current version of the guidelines unless there's an ex post facto issue. After dismissing our argument that there was an ex post facto issue, he made his ruling without talking about the version of the guidelines.
Thank
so I would
you.
Assume he followed the law in that respect.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Buttle.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just 2 points. First of all, what version of the guidelines the district court applied is not at issue in this appeal. The defendant did not appeal that, and neither did we.
The defendant got what he wanted in a sense, so there's nothing for him to appeal.
Well, so I think the only issue before this court, Your Honor, is whether or not the district court got it right under the 2015 guidelines. And I'd like to touch on...
Well, not if it applied the 2016 guidelines. It doesn't matter what the 2015 guidelines require if the court got it right under the 2016 guidelines and if that's the guidelines the court was considering?
Well, Your Honor, in the defendant's brief, he says the district court ruled Idaho robbery was not a crime of violence as that term was defined by Section 4B1.2 prior to Amendment 798, which essentially means the defendant is saying the district court applied the guidelines, the 2015 guidelines.
He's saying that we win under the 2015 guidelines. I don't think he's necessarily locking himself into a position that depends upon the 2015 guidelines. So,
Your Honor, and also I'd like to touch just on the defendant's proposal of this standard, affirming on any ground in the record. That, I believe, is a civil standard. We would actually love for it to be criminal because in most cases we are the appellee and that would help us out quite a bit. But the reason why I think it's civil is if we look at Cortez Arias, which is the case the defendant cites for that standard, the court quotes the standard in a footnote. But really what the court does in Cortez Arias is it reviews de novo whether a crime of conviction is actually a crime of violence. Now, I traced the citation that the Cortez Arias case gave for that standard back four cases, and each of those cases is, in fact, a civil case. And I found that to be the case with other cases in this circuit where that standard has crept into criminal cases. It seems that the court cites a civil case for the standard, but really goes on to apply the relevant criminal standard. And so I submit that that's actually a civil standard and not applicable here. Even if it were the correct standard, Your Honor, there's no ground in the record for this court to affirm because there's no evidence that the district court considered the 2016 guidelines and specifically Amendment 798. There's no evidence in the record of what the district court would have
done.
Why
couldn't we consider the amendment? And that's purely a legal question, isn't it?
It is, but again, like I mentioned,
the district court was kind of begging for guidance from the Court of Appeals. Here we are.
Yeah, well, I think it's because that affirm on any ground in the record really is a civil standard and is not applicable here, although we would love for it to be applied in criminal cases.
Put that aside. I mean, if our interpretation of the law is that as it stands now, or under the 2016 guidelines, since now 2018, under the 2016 guidelines, and I think continuing, the definition of extortion has changed. Mm-hmm. And we are capable of saying as a matter of law that because this definition isn't a categorical match to this definition, you don't have the predicate offense. What could the district court add to that? There's no factual findings to be made here, are there?
Well, I think it's appropriate to send back to the district court.
I mean, I'm fine. I'm happy to let him do the heavy lifting, but I don't know what it is he would decide that isn't going to be promptly appealed to us. So maybe we can make three of our colleagues deal with this question in a year, but how's the question change? And if you're telling me, as best as we know, and I don't know, and I'm not trying to put words into your mouth, but if our court's going to consider that in a briefed fashion in Nichols, rather than send it back to the district court, why wouldn't we just sit here and wait for Nichols to tell us if this is a categorical match or not?
Well, I think it's important to reverse the sentence in this case because I think the district court very clearly got it wrong under
not
the 2015
so
guidelines.
Not well, so clear to me.
I think it clearly got it wrong under the 2015 guidelines.
But even if we would agree with you on that, if we know this other issue here is going to impact on the sentence, I mean, I'm really trying to figure out if there's a reason why we should send it back as opposed to either decide ourselves or let our colleagues in Nichols decide this other issue. Because if that's going to control the sentence, it really doesn't help anybody to recycle the case again, does it? I mean, if there's something the district court can add to that, I'd like to know it, but I don't see it yet.
Well, I think the district court can add clarity and make a clear determination as to which version of the guidelines it's applying, and then make a decision whether it counts as a crime of violence under those guidelines. So I would ask that the court reverse and remand for resentencing. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you to both counsel for your helpful arguments in this case. The case just argued is submitted for a decision by the court. The next case on calendar for argument is Brasley versus Fearless Ferris Service Stations.